My name is Tam. You're listening to Popular Education. Today, we are going to be celebrating the life of Jomo Kenyatta. Some of you might not know who that is, and that's totally fine, because unfortunately, we weren't really taught about him and his legacy. So here's just a short little tidbit that's going to give you a pretty nice intro into his life. So here you go.
The founding father, Mzee Jomo Kenyatta, was a man on a mission and with a vision right from the onset. His mission was specifically to see Kenya become an independent state, liberated from the yoke of the British colonialists, and also to achieve pan-Africanism throughout the African continent. This dream came to fruition in 1945 when he and other prominent African nationalist figures like Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana helped to organize the 5th Pan-African Congress in Britain.
We believe that Kenyans are one nation. It is also consistent with the African people's past and present efforts to secure unity. It is also the logical answer to the challenge which Kenya or any new nation must face after independence. The consolidation of independence, urgent economic reconstruction and development, the need to make an impact and have influence at Pan-African and international affairs must be our immediate aim.
The first hint at this mission was upon arrival from Britain when he declared, "We have come out of the yoke of colonialism."
What we have been struggling for is to redeem our country from the yoke of colonialism.
Even before he ascended to the highest office in the land, his love for the motherland of Kenya and its people was evident in the way he dealt with the colonial masters. Mzee Kenyatta was a selfless leader. He managed to galvanize the struggle for Kenya's independence.
My leadership has not been to darkness and death, but to light and prosperity.
And it is because of this that he, along with five other nationalists, including Achieng Oneko, Paul Ngei, Bildad Kaggia, Kung'u Karumba, and Fred Kubai, were detained in Kapenguria for their quest for a free and independent Kenya. They were famously known as the Kapenguria Six. This detention flamed the independence struggle, which was kept alive by other nationalists as the Kapenguria Six were locked up. The armed struggle that was to follow these events finally culminated to Kenya attaining her independence and Mzee Jomo Kenyatta being installed first as Prime Minister when Kenya got the nod for internal self-rule and then as President in 1964 when it became a republic. His policy was that of continuity and gradual Africanization of the government, keeping many colonial civil servants in their old jobs as they were gradually replaced by Kenyans. As president, one of the most memorable of Mzee Jomo Kenyatta's legacies was a call for a united country. His almost incessant call for Harambee, or pulling together as a nation, was a testament to this.
Harambee!
Yes.
Harambee!
Yes.
Harambee!
Yes.
Na mashamba yetu harambee!
Yes.
Na mifugo yetu harambee!
Yes.
Na serikali yetu tukufu harambee!
Yes.
He firmly rallied against tribalism and divisive politics, and he believed that through national unity, vices like poverty, disease, and ignorance would have no place in Kenya. Mzee Kenyatta was also a firm believer of justice and equality. This was even evident in his book, Suffering Without Bitterness, where he advocated for reconciliation and tolerance for the white race after all the suffering they had put the Kenyan people through. Mzee Kenyatta's call for unity went beyond the borders. His relationship with the presidents of the East African region and Africa at large was cordial, and business amongst the East African community flourished greatly. The economic growth then was being compared to the Asian tigers. Mzee Jomo Kenyatta's ideals for the struggle of freedom in Africa and beyond were replicated in many countries, and these shaped and determined Africa's political landscape during this particular era. A writer of note, a father and husband, and most importantly, the founding father of the nation. He was truly a man of the people.
Good evening, and you are still listening to Popular Education. How's it going, Mike?
Am I on the air?
Yes, you are, and we can hear you. Lovely.
That's fantastic. I am doing great. It's always a good night, a good Thursday night to come and listen and participate in this great popular education here. And that piece was very, very, we were doing a little talking behind the scenes, and that was a lot of information. That was a lot to digest. What an amazing human being.
Yes, and it does not even end there. So hopefully you tuned in and listened to that little bit. And just to highlight a little bit more about his life as the amazing Kenyatta, we'll just talk a little bit about him and his upbringing. So he was born sometime in the 1890s. I was trying to look around and find information about an exact date, but I just couldn't really find anything. There wasn't too much stuff online about, there was just too many dates, so I couldn't pick one. So I'm just going for the general one. So he was born to a Kikuyu farmer parents, and that's an ethnic group within Kenya. At the time, Kenya was a protectorate, or quote unquote, British East Africa. I can't even say that with a straight face.
Yeah. Just getting into what that would mean is, it's like, you know, I don't know. How would you describe that to a person that really doesn't understand the magnitude of that masquerade?
Yeah, right. But interestingly enough, at the time, that's what it was called at the time, which is now modern Kenya. And just as a little tidbit, a protectorate is its own state, but it's merely protected by a larger country, whereas a colony is a part of a larger country governed by the same country. Kenya was not a colony at that time. It wasn't until 1920 that it became a colony until its liberation in 1963. So according to an article published by the Nouribian, in 1914, when Kenyatta was about 25 years old, he began showing his political wits and exercising small forms of resistance against the British. And so I'm just going to read a little bit from the actual newspaper. In the shape-shifting duality that would mark his character all his life, Kamata, which is Kenyatta's original name, wanted to be christened John Peter. But on being instructed to only choose one Christian name, he creatively went for Johnstone. And by the stroke of his genius, this marked the first significant step out of his outmaneuvering the British, while at the same time exploiting their tongue, English. And in this way, we would see him literally use his tongue to get into the state house half a century later. For with his mastery of carpentry, English reading and writing ability, and smothering speaking skills of the Queen's tongue, Jamestown Kamatu came to town as one very educated African man. Very quickly he realized that he can use the fact that he speaks English and he can use the language for his own betterment and for the betterment of his people. So he didn't quite, he got within the system. And this is a really interesting story of a person who got within the system and changed it.
It's basically understanding the surroundings and equipping yourself with the necessary items in order to make your to progress for mm-hmm. yourself.
Definitely.
And that's definitely what he did. That showed a higher level of intelligence and awareness at that time for him.
Yeah, and it's the awareness that's really important. And it's not just that he did this for himself to better himself. There was a big part that he was doing this for his people. Like I mentioned, he is an ethnic minority within Kenya, and he did a lot of stuff. We'll get into it a little bit later to help his people. So around 1917, the British settlers were looking for body-abled men to fight World War I. Obviously, Kenyatta had no interest whatsoever in joining the army to fight for the British, so he fled to live with relatives, which I don't think was cowardice at all. I think it was more of a protest than anything, but, you know, my opinion. By 1919, after the war, he was working at a market for a Mazungu, which is named for a person of European descent. His name was Stephen Ellis in Nairobi. An interesting tidbit, a lot of different places in Africa have names for people who are of European descent.
They were quite fond of presidents and politicians and people of European descent. They would use their Christian name,
yes,
I assume.
And also with him, he also had a lot of European influence. He became political around the 1920s. He joined the Kekyu Central Association, which was a political organization in colonial Kenya formed in 1924. And it acted as kind of like a community representation in order to express concerns to the British government for minorities within Kenya. And in 1926, Kenyatta helped in drafting letters and translating, and later became the association's secretary. His political activist work continued, and in 1929, he started writing articles in English. So that's what I'm talking about being able to use what you got to change the circumstances for yourself and for your people. So he wrote this paper called Give Back Our Land. And he also wrote about the unrest that was happening in Kenya at the time. And he wrote all this in English. So it actually got to English news outlets like the New York Times, believe it or not. And by 1931, he leaves Kenya for Britain. And he actually goes to a parliament commission to put his work and his kind of to explain what's going on with his people, specifically the Kikyanu Central Association. And so he goes to Parliament in Britain and he talks to the commission there. Later on, he attended the University of Moscow, the University College of London, and the London School of Economics. So really well-educated person who managed to teach himself. He also paid his way through school or his early education by being, believe it or not, a house slave for a white family.
A participant in a household.
Yep.
So, I mean, I'm just listening to the story and going over it myself as well. I can't help from seeing the pattern of laying down the foundation in order to equip himself,
mm-hmm. yes.
in order to better himself.
Mm-hmm.
And just the idea of an African, a Kenyan, speaking English and mastering the English language put him in a different category. And he was viewed differently.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was. And he also from working with Stephen Ellis, he learned a lot about European culture. So more about how to dress more like a European. And in some of the documentaries and stuff that I was reading about, he dressed very European and very modern, but he still had this specific hat and also a belt that was more of his people and like of his tribe. So it's still, you know, kind of like best of both worlds.
Yeah, he kept his attachment to his roots and mm-hmm. his culture, and I can see this is just a side commentary. It's like for us to judge a person based upon the appearance of the person or based upon what you see the person doing in order to bring about a change on a higher level, on a wider scale. What he did in sacrifice, learning the English language, mastering the English language, mastering the European culture, embracing the style. It could be easily perceived as something else.
Oh, but yeah, if like selling out.
Right.
Yeah.
Unless you're looking at the big picture. And he had the foresight and the vision to see change. When you change, you have to change and make it your advantage. And that's where you can say the positive, where the positive started happening. You can see where his people were more recognized and change was coming about for his people. And he had more influence on what was happening on the outcome.
Yeah. And it wasn't, and even though he was, you know, like you mentioned, you know, had the European garbs and spoke English and all that stuff, he still used that power in order to vocalize his people's issues on a scale and to other people and parties and committees that can actually get something moving, you know. So it's, you know, people in activism and in organizing people, you know, there are lots of school of thoughts about how to do it, and some people say, you know, like play the game until the, you know, so many different ways and
fake it till you make it.
Fake it till you make it.
I can't. I don't like that term. I do not like it.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting connotations to that, but it's just interesting that he could manage to do it and not lose himself, because I bet he had so many opportunities where he could have just lost himself. And this is,
I mean, the scrutiny, the rejection.
Well, but the thing, the people loved him. The people loved him so much. And I think that's also maybe something that is just different when someone comes into your house and they try to take your stuff, you know, because they were getting colonized. And then to have someone from your, you know, tribe, not just your tribe, someone from a minority tribe.
Look like you and amongst you and dress like you and say, stand up and say, look, this is wrong. I'm not going to let this happen.
Yeah. And him still being able to, you know, he gained all these things like being able to speak English and all that stuff and being able to kind of like deal with the European culture. But he still went back and did translating, drafting letters and stuff like that. So, you know, he's, it's interesting, you know, one thing from researching, again, I'm not a historian, I just did a lot of research for this episode, in reading about him, he never, like I said, he never lost touch with who he was, you know, he never forgot where he came from, and I don't know what it was.
Dedication.
Yeah, it is.
Loyalty.
Yeah.
Conviction.
All those things.
So many things. Integrity is so many things that. I mean, just looking at the finished picture, we can all look in awe and amazement. But actually going through that process, it took many years and it took a lot of convincing and it took time.
And in a place of where it's your home and then people are coming in there and then you leave in order to figure out how to come back to make it better. And in 1936, this is just to explain what kind of fellow this he was, excuse me, what type of person Kenyette was. Let me not call him a fellow, considering he was like one of the founding fathers of Kenya. In 1936, he broke through a police cordon in London Railroad Station to express solidarity with Emperor Haile Selassie of Ethiopia at the time. So, you know, he loved Ethiopia. He actually had the fly swatter, and the fly swatter is an Ethiopian symbol. It's symbolic of peace. So it's a fly swatter, but when you swat it around, it's just like a white, it's like a white fabric, or it's like some sort of animal hair, and it looks like very peaceful. It's like almost like having a white flag up. So it's like hello, or just kind of like a, you know, a peaceful gesture.
A gentle nudge.
And then by 1938, he published an anthropological study of his people. And in the introduction of the book, it had the book had an introduction by, let me try to say this name, Brineslow Milinowski, who is, ironically enough, the father of social anthropology. So I should probably know
you how awesome. To say his name. You knocked that out of the park.
Thank you. It had a lot of vowels, and it ends with a W, so it's hard. And I did want to mention that in the book that describes his people, the book section include things like tribe's origin, economic life, sex life amongst young people, new religion, magical and medicinal practices. So it was very, again, you know, like we're talking, very open-minded. You know, it's not, you know, I'm from African, and I know that talking about sex isn't something that we do. So to have a book that expresses that in to foreigners, it's like, whoa, you really just want people to understand what we are. You want to give the full picture of your tribe without holding anything back. And it shows how progressive he is. In my opinion, I think it shows that he's very progressive.
Certainly. I mean, the vision and the boldness.
The bold, yes.
I mean, like, the courage it takes to take that stand, to not, the urge to do what everyone else does, mm-hmm. the impulse to do according to status quo, and to resist that impulse and go the opposite direction, mm-hmm. and actually stay hold to it and mm-hmm. hold on to it and stay the course. It takes a phenomenal person, and I can't say enough about.
And to not be scared of, you know, like the judgment, because.
Oh, I'm sure know. I'm sure he had a lot of sleepless nights, but I mean, just the end result.
Yeah.
Is that he was extremely courageous and brave.
And you keep mentioning the word visionary, and that's all the people who talk about him. That's the word that they use, is visionary, because he was so ahead of his time in the way that he approached even the colonizers after Kenya became liberated. So that's a whole thing of its own. And I actually have a really nice recording of him speaking with the colonizers after he won the election, after Kenya was liberated. And, you know, they were scared, but he's like, hey, don't worry about it. We'll figure this out. So he was in Europe, Moscow, London, all over in Europe during the 30s. And then in 1946, he returned to Kenya. His efforts of giving a voice to the ethnic groups in Kenya and showing Kenyan life to folks in the UK during the 30s, alongside his anti-colonial sentiments and ideas, landed him a job as a school principal as soon as he got back to Kenya. Unfortunately, a little bit under 10 years of being back home, Kenyatta was put on trial by the British for supposedly being the commander of a guerrilla group called the Mau Mau, or the Meow Meow. I'm sorry, I'm not saying that right. It was never proven. But again, like, a lot of people have also mentioned that it's possible that he was the leader of it. It was never proven, but yeah, many suspect that it was true. And in 1953, he was sentenced to 7 years of hard labor. But upon his release, oh, everyone celebrated. I think it said something like 10,000 people came. He got a hero's welcome. And then by 61, the government flew him out. That's when he got in 1961, the government flew him out, and he always maintained his innocence. And that's when he got released, and they flew him out to Marilal, and that's where he was freed. They say that he told reporters that he holds no grudges, and he kept explaining, he kept maintaining his innocence, and he was explaining that he never supported violence or any kind of illegal oathing system used by the guerrilla group. He denied ever being a Marxist, stating, quote unquote, "I shall always remain an African nationalist to the end," end quote. That's pretty beautiful. And again, if you're wondering where that Marx relation comes, you have to remember he also went to school in Moscow. So there was socialism in Africa as a thing, as much as maybe we aren't aware of it here. It is definitely a thing. A lot of proxy wars have been played out in that region.
Such a poetic story. Is just so just the adventure and the mastery of how a person can come from poverty and the lack of education and just rise up, mm-hmm. and have become a leader of their people.
Yeah. And I wonder, like, what kind of you know, his parents must have been such amazing people, you know, just like. Or maybe not. I don't know. He it does take a special kind of person and a special kind of bravery to be able to endure all these kind of things. And also people who served with him in his government, they all say pretty much the same thing. And it's really nice to be able to hear, you know, just everyone kind of feeling the same way. So with that being said, I'm going to play a little bit of a documentary that I found very enjoyable. It's from CGNT. And I'm going to play it for you. And we'll be back in just a little bit.
But championed that cause, but the one person who brought that movement, gave it the blood, the stamina, if you like, the strength that stretched across the country and made it a real nationalistic movement, was Jomo Kenyatta. He was a charismatic man with the gift of the gab. He spoke damn well when he addressed a public meeting. He could electrify the crowd. So it was natural that every Kenyan just loved him.
The early 1950s saw the rise in Kenya of the Mau Mau, freedom fighters ready to use violence as a means to an end. In response, the British declared a state of emergency in which tens of thousands of Kenyans were detained or killed. In October 1952, Kenyatta, now in his 60s, was arrested and accused of managing the Mau Mau, a charge he always denied. He was sentenced to 7 years hard labor. On his release from detention in 1961, his resolve and following were even stronger.
Kenyatta was overwhelming as a speaker to his people. I remember once I saw him speak about independence, mainly for Kenya. And of course, this was bad news for the settler who insisted that Kenya will never be independent.
When do you want independence for Kenya?
Today.
To the settler, he was a devil. There's no question about that. He's Satan incarnate.
But post-World War II, the British Empire was shrinking fast, and by the early 1960s, Britain was making plans to pull out. Kenyatta's party won elections in Kenya in 1963. He became prime minister, and the path to independence was paved.
This is one of the happiest days of my life.
But while Kenyans were thrilled with their new leader, the British white settlers were less so.
Everyone was scared, if I might say, of what was going to happen to their easy way of life.
The white settlers requested a meeting with Kenyatta.
That meeting took place in a hall in Nakuru. And the white settlers who were in Kenya that time, many of them were there. The hall was full.
Dr. Njoroge Mungai, then in his 30s, was one of four government advisors Kenyatta took with him.
Our advice at that time, this has never been told before, was that we don't want these people to stay. We want them to go quickly. When you tell them, give some kind of notice for them to know that the land must go back to the people. He said yes, yes, yes. So we went there. And we sat down, then President Kenyatta started talking. Well, we expected to hear dates mentioned when they had to leave, but that's not what we heard.
I think some of you have been maybe worried what will happen if Kenyatta comes to be the head of the government. Well, now let me set you to rest that Kenyatta has no intention whatsoever to look backward. We are going to forgive the past.
That speech was a very good one. he says, stop, look, calm down, boys. I'm not going to slit your throat. If you behave yourselves and don't throw your weight around, there's a future for you here.
That's not what we thought he was going to say. But it was, the meeting went off very well. And they asked any questions, he handled them beautifully. We admired him. But still, he didn't say something that we had asked him to say. So when we finished the meeting, we went back to the small room just to discuss with him. Well, Mzee Kenyatta said, yes, I listened to you very carefully. I listened to your advice very well, but I did not accept your advice. If you look at it now, it was a very smart and a very wise way of doing it. We were men in a hurry, youth in a hurry, and we wanted to see them get out and get their notice. But he was much wiser than us.
Tolerance and cooperation were the hallmarks of the new Kenyatta presidency. He coined the phrase Harambe, meaning let's pull together, and it became a national slogan. But though he'd invited the white settlers to make Kenya their home, he found it difficult to think of State House, previously the British seat of government, as his.
He would not sleep at State House because he said there were ghosts of white people. He said that he couldn't sleep because there were ghosts of white people and the frogs were croaking. He thought they were saying he shouldn't be there.
From then on, every night, however late, Kenyatta made a 50-kilometer journey to Gatundu. As well as being his birthplace, it was now the location of the home he shared with his wife, Ngina, and their four children, Christine, Uhuru, Anna, and Muhoho. Ngina was Kenyatta's fourth wife. He had four more children from earlier marriages, including one to a British woman while living in the UK.
Yeah. At heart, he was still a very sentimental Kikuyu person and loved in the evening nothing more than to have dozens of women chanting away in their tribal songs night after night after night. He loved that sort of thing.
When it came to his country, however, Kenyatta was modern and progressive. Under his leadership, the infrastructure grew and the economy prospered.
As soon as independence came and Kenyatta government was formed, I think it was as if the whole world was waiting for it. A lot of investors moved in. The economy was very, very lively. I think his leadership really spearheaded the economic development.
In building this new nation, Kenyatta had an overriding priority.
Number one for Kenyatta was education. He regarded his education as a very important instrument in the governance of the country. Successful education system was very important to him.
In 1966, the Jomo Kenyatta Foundation was set up. Its mandate, to use proceeds from the sale of textbooks to pay for deprived children to go to school, continues to this day.
Nelius, Nelius, come and demonstrate to us how to construct a perpendicular bisector of the line AB.
You first construct a lane.
Thanks to the foundation, 15-year-old Nelius Wangari is now studying at a girls' boarding school in Nairobi. As well as nurturing his new nation, Kenyatta was successful in forging links abroad. During the years following independence, he regularly played host to visiting dignitaries and heads of states.
Prince Charles, Princess Anne came here and they wanted to see him at home. I was foreign minister then, so I took them to Gatundu, his home. And they sat there in an African setting, all of them being very comfortable, talking, laughing about their own country, about this country, and they also felt quite happy. He was able to adjust to anybody.
He had a wonderful sense of humor. Outside the public arena, if you met him in private, he was full of jokes. He had very good sense of humor. He made people laugh, and his memory was just wonderful.
On other occasions, however, Kenyatta could show a different side.
He had a terrible temper sometimes. I remember once Jomo Kenyatta, he had called the Baluhya people to talk to them about fighting in their area. They had been burning of houses, and Jomo said, look, I'm not going to send the police to find out who it is. It's one of you. But one of the people tried to justify the situation and used some words that were very unpleasant to Jomo Kenyatta. So he threw that fly whisk to him.
As the years progressed, it's claimed, Kenyatta became increasingly intolerant of dissent. He had the Kenyan constitution amended to extend his powers. In the euphoria of independence, politicians of different backgrounds and beliefs had joined together. But within a few years, factions were forming, and Oginga Odinga, once Kenyatta's ally and vice president, set up an opposition party. Rivalries came to a head when, in 1969, both men turned up at the opening of Kisumu Hospital in Western Kenya. The crowd, mainly Odinga supporters and members of his ethnic group, the Luo, began heckling Kenyatta.
A scuffle broke out in which, on the main dais of these VIPs, somebody threw a chair in Kenyatta's direction. Well, Kenyatta obviously was very well prepared, and so were his people, for trouble. And trouble then began in a serious way. There was an awful lot of shoving and pushing.
There was a lot of noise that was being made. And the voices were drowned. And of course, it was the duty of the police to protect and keep peace.
The bodyguard of Kenyatta surrounded him and started firing outwards in a general kind of way. It was terrifying. The main crowd were about 100 meters away, and they started shouting anti-Kenyatta slogans. And Kenyatta somehow managed to get the microphone back and started to insult in a very salty way the Luo people in general. And on the VIP standstill, Odinga kept shouting back at Kenyatta. So it was a very, very explosive situation.
At least 10 people died in the shooting. Just days later, Odinga's political party was banned, turning Kenya effectively into a one-party state, and Odinga himself was arrested and detained.
Good evening. You're listening to Popular Education here at the KBOO studio. Just had a little bit information about Kenyatta and his political route. Also mentioned Odinga, which it was his vice president, as you heard, who later, unfortunately, became a political rival. So we're going to talk about that a little bit more after we listen to the super duper groovy track. Here you are. Thank you very much.
Yenye bahari na misitu mabonde ni ya rutuba misitu ni ya wanyama ibariki Afrika ino ibariki Afrika ino aye bara la Afrika bara la Afrika bara letu Africa,
Africa.
That was fantastic.
I like that too.
I wasn't finished
dancing yet.
Yeah. Mike was dancing here in the studio, just in case someone was wondering.
Open mic music and Tammy in the building doing this popular education.
Yes, not Papa, popular education. And that was David Amunagu and the Ella Gates song called Umaju Wa Africa. I'm so sorry. I just butchered that. I did try.
She's doing it. She's doing some lyrical acrobatics over here. She's like doing a twister.
Yes. Lyrical genius. Yeah. So the last, I just wanted to kind of talk about the Kenyatta legacy as of today. There is the schools, there are the highways, there are the political thought books that are still being studied and in Kenya and other places within in Africa. And just like here we have the Clintons and we have the Bushes, that's kind of what their situation is right now. So Kenyatta did have four wives, I believe, a lot of wives and a lot of kids. And most of them did end up in politics or having some sort of like highbrow positions like that. And then the Odenga, who was his vice president and also ended up being political rival, his children also became very politically involved. So what's going on right now in Kenya is like, so the Odenga camp, for lack of better words, or the legacy, they're more of like the socialist kind of the rile up the masses versus Kenyatta, who is more of like the capitalist behind the scenes, like running the show kind of thing. And he's still very much loved, revered, missed, and respected to this day in Kenya. And we all know Harambe, you know, it's really fantastic from the inception of Kenya's liberty to now in 2019. His name reigns supreme and they're not forgetting who he is. And I think about a couple hours ago, I think like maybe 20 hours ago at this point, they were having a beautiful memorial ceremony in downtown Kenya in Nairobi, I believe. And it was really nice. It's really, really nice to see that people still remember that legacy. And I was kind of sad that I didn't know more about him from just the schooling that I got here in the States. And now that I do know, it's this one more person I can look up to. Isn't that right, Mike?
It's been a very enlightening and inspiring journey, mm-hmm. listening to the story. And I'm in the same category as you. We don't learn enough about these great leaders, and that's why we have shows and podcasts like Pop Ed,
Popular Education.
I was going to do both.
I'm not patient enough.
And we're just making sure that, I mean, it's noteworthy that a man of his stature and a man of his vision,
mm-hmm.
be appreciated and recognized and remembered.
Yes.
Because it's very important. I mean, our liberties are not here just by chance. You know, nobody's just going to say, I mean, like, as you can see, the opposition against him, they weren't giving him anything. They weren't saying it was okay for him to have anything. Everything that he got, he earned and he worked hard for.
Yeah. And so today I was really happy to be able to have the show to discuss him, his legacy, his life, his work. Since in 1978, on August 22nd, he did pass away after suffering a heart attack. And then another person who also passed away August 22nd, but in 1989, is another great Black leader, Huey P. Newton. Would you like to take us?
Oh, that's another away, Mike? Another amazing a visionary.
Mm-hmm.
He had a great vision and he had an ideal. And at the time in the U.S., it was a need for a transition. We were going in the U.S. They were going through a period of time where it was peaceful marching and peaceful protests, and somehow that changed and it turned to more aggressive protesting and more aggressive stand-ins, and more Black groups started to emerge. And one of the Black groups that one of the few Black groups that emerged was the Congress of African People, the Revolutionary Movement, the Deacons of Defense and Justice. And the most noteworthy of these groups was one other group was the Republic of New Africa. And the most noteworthy of all these groups was the Black Panther Party of Self-Defense. Was their original name, and it was founded in 1966 by one Huey P. Newton and one Bobby Seale. We include Bobby Seale because, according to history, it was a collaborative, but in all reality, all indications say that this was exclusively a Huey P. Newton project. And Huey P. Newton was the Minister of Defense and the chief he was the chief engineer for education.
Oh, okay.
Black education.
Gotcha.
And there's been over 30 books published about the Black Panther Party from the inception. And Huey P. Newton was eloquently known for his he was trying to abolish the discrimination and the oppression of race oppression, class oppression, and gender.
Yeah, and he was really big in women's liberation, too.
Yeah. He was not about any oppression of any kind.
Not at all.
And he educated himself while during incarceration. And the reason why he was incarcerated, because he was accused of a shootout that involved a police officer, and the casualty of the shootout with the officer unfortunately resulted in the fatality of a woman. And he was accused of this, and he served time. And during the time he was incarcerated, he got a PhD in social psychology.
A PhD? Oh, my God.
I mean, and
he
just
taught himself
up
to read, too, right?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Unbelievable.
And so much. And I mean, listening to the both stories of both of these gentlemen, and listening to how much the next level their life changed once they started educating themselves and equipping themselves. I don't know if that was a word, but they gave themselves the right materials and the right equipment.
Armed themselves, armed themselves with education.
Armed themselves with education, and that was something that enabled them to move further and push further onto their goals. Unfortunately, later on, in addition to all the things that Huey P. Newton obtained during the time of his struggle and his fight for equality. He did educate a lot. He did influence a lot of children. He did open up several schools in his hometown. And unfortunately, in 1989, he was murdered in Oakland, California.
In the same place that he was trying to, you know, trying to fix, trying to uplift.
Yes. And according to reports, one Tyrone Robinson, and they were saying that he was a member of a rival membership, Black Guerrilla Party, a Black Guerrilla Family. I'm sorry. So, yeah, these are influential, powerful individuals who fought for the rights and the liberties of the people to which they live with and people to which they reside in and help uplifting their community. And you see those reflections today. That need for someone to uplift, not just one individual, because it's not just an individual job.
But yeah, that's true. And both on August 22nd, I'm so glad that you could share that information with us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very powerful individuals. And yeah.
Yeah. I know there's I know there's parks. I know there's schools. You definitely hear that name getting read. Not enough, I got to say. Not as much as I'd like to hear Huey being mentioned, but better than the alternative, right?
It's definitely better than the alternative. And I want to say, just before we get to close it out, I appreciate you having me on the show. It's always a pleasure to be here.
We thank you. Yes. We love having you here. You are the co-host of this here show. So it's only suitable that you're here, right?
Yes. And I just want to say really quickly, there's a lot of things going on this weekend.
What's going on? You tell us.
And you might want to check out Primetime over at Comedy Sports or Northwest Kearney. There's an invitation show going on. A great group of characters are going to be performing at 9:00. You want to definitely check that out. It's going to be tons of fun. And if you want to check out some music, some good R&B music, check out Freeform Portland on Monday between 12 and 2. You want to listen to Urban Human Being playing some music just for the funk of it.
Yay. Anything else you want to update us about? You know everything that's happening all the time. I love it.
I try to stay busy.
You do.
Portland
is
a great place to stay busy and a great place to have fun. And
it is.
And popular education. I'm so happy. I thank all of you for listening.
Yes, we are getting listeners from all over, and we really appreciate all of your help, support. And if you want to vocalize your help and support and love, appreciation, have any questions, comments, concerns, you can email us at populareducationradio@gmail.com. or Instagram us at Popular Education Radio. That's just a handle name. Or you can pop by the station, say hello, give high fives. You see me down the street, say hey.
Yeah, just wave really loudly and say, hey, how you doing? Yeah. Or you could definitely, like I said, check out the invite at Comedy Sports. They got Def the Barbie. They got Hadley McGee Particle. And they got POC of PDX. That's POC of PDX performing at the Comedy Sports Invite this Saturday at 9.
And where'd you say it was?
Northwest Kearney.
Northwest. Oh, it's Northwest. On the fancy side of town.
Yes.
Fancy.
Yes.
Awesome. And again, we are here for you. And if you ever want to reach out to us, please free to do so. I really enjoy being here. And I love all of the positive feedback that I'm getting back. I'm really getting to hear from local people, non-local people, people listening on the radio, people listening afterwards, and it's really awesome.
Give them that handle or that podcast that they can catch you on.
Yeah, you can find us at Popular Education Radio on the Instagram or populareeducationradio@gmail.com. Mike, what about you if they're trying to see what you're up to?
You can catch me on Instagram at Urban Human Being. That's Urban Human Being on Instagram. You can feel free to follow me.
Feel free. That's a lot of stuff. Sweet. Thank you all so much. And just shouting out Food Not Bombs in Portland, because they do a lot of great stuff for people who really need it. And I'm gonna play one more song for you as I casually walk out of the studio so you can enjoy it. Take care of yourselves and each other. We are all that we have.
Kamala Male, oh mama, Kamala Male.